So, first question today, how to live peacefully with my parents, who are both in 70s and late 60s. I can't talk to them more than 2 minutes, then the voice will be louder and become a fight. Please guide. Thank you. So from the amount of laughter, I'm assuming this is a problem for more than one person. I think that there's probably a prefix, like an international prefix for the word family, and it's family. It's like a big tonjaya. Communication in families is usually fraught with this kind of problem. One common reason is that our parents tend to have very fixed ideas of who we are, which they're established when we're young. And they find very difficult to change that idea of who we are. And that's made, it's compounded or made particularly strong because parents tend to have this belief that nobody knows my children like I do. So they have a very strong investment in a particular idea of who you are. And so if you feel that who you are now is has changed in any way from who you were or your mother or father's opinion of who you are, then that's a sure recipe for disagreement and arguments. Having said that, it's not a hopeless case, and if there's any kind of argument or conflict, what we have to do is move away from what we call the blame game. So the blame game is who's to blame for this, and this is kind of a automatic kind of reflex. Who's to blame? Like in the West, particularly this comes up now when this whole idea of blaming the victim, you know, is if someone suggests that someone who's been hurt or in some way contributed in any kind of way to what happened, then it's immediately condemned as blaming the victim. But in Buddhism, we don't talk about who's right and who's wrong in that very black and white kind of way. We say, what are the contributory factors? What contributes to this conflict? So the contribution to any conflict is never going to come just from one side. And so trying to look at this, you know, what the kinds of things are the particular trigger points that tend to bring up this arum very easily, and what is contributing to it on their side, on your parents' side, and how are you contributing towards it through your attitude, your words, your actions? Because unless you can see your own contribution to the problem, then there's not going to be any resolution of it. Now, in Thailand and our culture here, then we usually defer to our elders. That doesn't mean that our elders are always right, but this is a convention. And to keep peace at home, one of the things is, you know, Choose your battles. If there are battles you have to fight sometimes and stand your ground, then make sure it's on really things that are really important to you and your values. Don't argue about every single point. Be willing to compromise and be willing to follow your parents in certain areas, certain things you don't really agree. But you do that as a out of respect, deference for them. And then it's like you, every time you do that, it's almost like you put a deposit into this kind of emotional bank account. And then when you have requests or you have things that your parents don't particularly agree with, they're willing to compromise as well. But the in terms of Dhamma practice, then this cultivation of empathy and trying to look at like these kind of difficult topics through their eyes. How do they see it? So sometimes, you know, when we have these kind of arguments, we feel that we're completely logical. We've got reason on our side, and the people we disagree with are being completely illogical. But you have to be willing to give the other person the benefit of the doubt, and you ask yourself a question: How is it possible, based on what kind of thinking, can they see their position as being logical? Because for sure they do. They feel they're being logical. So on what grounds would they be able to think like that? So this ability just to put your own side of things down for a moment and really put yourself in their shoes, trying to see things as they see them, is an incredibly important gift. Otherwise, the kinds of observation need to make is like, are there particular times and places and occasions when these kinds of arguments tend to flare up? Now, often if either side is already tired, a bit stressed out, something on their mind, then those are danger times when you need to be extremely mindful, because our restraint and our care over how we speak tends to decline when we're tired or we're stressed out. So, you know, if you either you or your parents are not in a good mood, or you've got something you really are already upset about, this is not a good time to enter into any kind of important conversation. So this mindfulness is, know what's going on in your body and mind right now. And if you're going to have a conversation with your parents about something important that often leads to disagreement, then the sense of time and place, what we call gala tesa, is really important to determine. I spoke yesterday in the afternoon about the, you know, the regrets I had about the kind of arguments with my parents as a teenager, and you know, when you look back on these things, they seem so petty and so silly. Having that humble heart and that good grace just to give way sometimes, just to please your parents, and to, if it's not something immoral they're asking you to do, if it's just something you just don't particularly like, then should at least be able sometimes to give up your likes and dislikes for your parents' peace of mind. As I say, if they're asking you to join in a expedition to rob a casino or to do something evil and immoral, then you know, then you can oppose them. But generally, it's not anything like that, is it? I'll leave that one for a moment. If you've got an incurable illness which may or may not lead to disability, I know that we'll all die one day, but when the illness gets worse, how to stop worrying, what if I become a disabled person, then no job, then no life, then miserable till I die? The point I've made a few times now is that we have to be able to recognize things for what they are. And one of the most important things is recognizing thinking as thinking. Now, that may seem very obvious, but it's very difficult to do, to see thinking as a mental activity, a conditioned mental activity. And that conditioned mental activity can cause all kinds of suffering. So one of the discoveries of cognitive psychology in past 10, 20 years is that human beings are very good at some things and very bad at some things. And some of them are quite surprising. For instance, vast majority of human beings are very bad at dealing with big numbers. We can't understand big numbers, and we make a lot of mistakes because of that. We also we're not very good with statistics. We're also very poor at forecasting our future happiness and suffering. And some of the experiments done on this topic are interesting, I think. For instance, case studies of two groups of people, people who won with the lottery and people who were in severe traffic accidents so that they're disabled, completely disabled, or I'm apart. So I think most of us would assume if someone was to say, if you were to win the lottery, come into a huge sum of money, 6 months from now, how do you think you'd feel? Or if you were in a terrible car accident and you're completely disabled, 6 months in future, how do you feel? In the first case, we think probably pretty good. In the second case, probably pretty bad. But surprisingly, what tends to happen is that after you have this one of these kinds of incredible events in your life, whether good or bad, you have a spike. So if you win the lottery, your subjective sense of happiness and fulfillment spikes up, goes up like that. But the theory is we all tend to have a basic kind of happiness level. This is for people who don't meditate or not cultivate, so you can say more or less stable. And someone who wins the lottery or wins an Olympic gold medal or whatever, very successful, the spike, and then within a few months, they're back down to the same level again. And what's incredible is this is proved in a number of cases, is similar to happens with people who are apart, who become paraplegic. They go through this very dark, very black period, But after 6 months or so, they more or less reestablish their basic level of happiness. They adapt to their situation in a way that we would think impossible. So when we are speculating about the future, what if? Oh, what if I could do this? What if I could do that? We need to recognize that the happiness, or what if I was to have this terrible illness, whatever, our ideas and our expectations of our basic level of pleasure or pain are completely unreliable. So this is problem here is, what if I've started saying, what if I become disabled, and what if this, and what? Yeah, that's just that's thinking, isn't it? But if you're taking things one step at a time, then often there are all kinds of compensatory factors that that you don't think about when you have this sort of big dramatic picture. And it's completely or largely unsure. But from our Buddhist practice, what we can assert, I think, quite confidently, is that the main conditioning factor of your subjective sense of happiness or unhappiness is the quality of your mind, and is your ability to take care of your mind and to cultivate wholesome mental states. So although we can't control our body, we can't control our future, we can at least say, well, we'll develop our inner resources to the level that we can be confident that we're ready to deal with whatever may happen in the future. Some people say you need to have suffering to understand Dhamma. Can you please explain? Well, this is one of those kind of statements which you have to pull apart a bit. The Buddha, pointing about the different kind of faculties and as spiritual maturity of different people, says that some people can actually be leading a very happy life, successful life, and yet hearing the Dhamma and hearing about suffering and hearing about old age and sickness and death and the human condition generally is enough to give them that kind of inspiration to practice the Dhamma. So they are hearing and reflecting on the suffering of the human condition generally, not their own suffering. And that's enough for people who have quite advanced faculties. Then there are people who hear about a relative or a friend who's got some terrible illness or has been in an accident and so on and so forth. And then that's enough. It just wakes them up. And, what's this all about? What are we really doing with our lives? What does this all mean? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? You have all these kind of questions come up. You start to wake up. And that can lead you into Dhamma practice. And then there are some people who are less sensitive, and it has to be something in their own life, some physical or mental pain or separation from one or something you love and something, and just enough just to stop you in your tracks. And you think, what am I doing with my life? What's this all about? What's a good thing to do? What's the best thing to do? So all these questions about the meaning and the purpose of our life coming through some pain and suffering that we experience ourselves. So people have different faculties, different levels of sensitivity. Some people merely reading a book on Buddhism and analysis of the human condition is enough. Other people, it has to personally affect someone you know and love or respect or friendly with. And then there are some who have to have some serious difficulty or setback in their own life. And then, of course, there are many people who, when that happens, completely uninterested in Dhamma and just completely committed to a heedless life. I have heard wise words and have learned good things from you these 2 days. I would like for my loved ones, friends and family to open minds and hearts for these teaching too. How can I invite, persuade them, especially those who are dear? one of the things that attracted me to Buddhism, when I was a teenager, particularly was, going back a bit, I've always been, I love study of history, great kind of history buff. And as an English person reading about modern or European history, then I find very difficult to understand how I could maintain any faith in the religions that were around me, and particularly reading about the missionary efforts around the world and the extent to which these were combined with military and economic and political pressure to try to change people's religion, have them convert to Christianity, or so this happens in Islam. And I just felt this sense of this is so wrong and unfair and disrespectful and so on. This is something that's very strong with me as a teenager. And the amount of violence done in the name of religion and the amount of deceit for me was shocking. So when I came across Buddhism, and I found that Buddhism is a religion that does not promote the idea that converting other people to Buddhism is a good thing. I was, wow, that's incredible. And it's the emphasis that each and every person has to come through their own volition, their own will. And then as a monk, discovering that even as a monk, we're not allowed to teach anybody who does not ask to be taught. So this is enshrined in the kinds of ceremonies we have. Before I give a Dhamma talk, there's this official chant of invitation. Give precepts. You have to invite me to give the precepts. There's never just a monk saying, I'm going to give you the precepts or I'm going to give you a talk. And monks can't just go up to somebody and sort of give them a book or tell them, have you heard good news about Buddhism or things like that, or knock on people's doors. And my mum, in her house, she is so irritated with these missionaries, Jehovah Witnesses who come around people's houses in England. And she always had this big photograph of me by the front door. So when these people knock on the door, I just show them a photograph. We are Buddhists. And So So the idea is that we're not missionaries, and we don't want to be pushing something, because that happens when you get very inspired. Obviously, you want to share it with the people you care about. But it's, you have also to respect other people's wishes and other people's views and opinions. So it's a more a matter of, you know, that kind of invitation or making things available and being able to say, look, saying in those very words, look, I found this so valuable in my own life, I can't help but want to share it. Would you be interested? If you are interested, I'd be happy to take you along to listen to a talk, or I can recommend a book if you would like that. But giving that person the option to say no, not putting any pressure or even psychological pressure. But the thing that will impress people the most is if they see that you're actually changing because of your own interest in Buddhism. If you're calmer, kinder, you're generally more patient, and all these good qualities becoming apparent to the people around you. You see people see changes. Say, maybe there's something in this after all. So that's the idea of like invitation, being willing to go out of your way to provide opportunities for people, but be really sure that they do have at least an initial interest. Don't be too pushy. You know, I know some people, they want they want their husbands to get interested. So every time they go in the car and they put on one of my Dhamma talks, you know, and then it's either the husband sees me and he's like, it's like, I have to listen to you every day, every time we get in the car. You know, this, you know, it doesn't really work by osmosis like that. You know, you're sort of, it doesn't. Well, okay, three questions. How to stop thinking in a loop or overthinking? Well, this is, you know, pretty much what I've been repeating again and again. It's just really hard work that you have to be willing to put in. It's just like learning the scales. You want to learn to play the piano. You want to learn to play a musical instrument. You want to be proficient in any kind of skill. You have to put a lot of hard work in the beginning, just getting the basics. And the basics of spiritual development are developing that sharpness of mind, as when you start on that, like, thinking, overthinking loop, you're right there at the beginning, and you can just let it go, and developing that kind of skill. So this is not mystical at all. It's basically like learning the scales on a learning how to play an instrument. It just needs this kind of concerted and consistent work to do it. So the two extremes are, one, you start to think, and then before you know it, you're completely engrossed in the thought. And the other is you just try and stop it and repress it and fight against it. Neither way is very successful. But when you recognize this is a thought, that's what it is. It's nothing more than that, nothing less than that. It's a phenomena. It's just a thought. It's not who you are. And you recognize it and you just then gently put it down. How to love without being attached. So we went into this topic a little bit yesterday and talking about all the different kinds of love there are, whether it's spiritual love, like metta, or parental love, romantic love, sexual love, so many different kinds of things that we lump under this one term of love. Well, I think that there's always going, for when there's personal love, love between particular human beings, whether it's in the family or with girlfriend, boyfriend, or romantic partners and so on, there's always going to be a certain amount of attachment there, and particularly the love that a parent has for a child. We think of a parent-child relationship. Well, don't think that, it's like an equal way thing. You know, the attachment of the parent to the child is so much stronger and it never goes away. And so that's something you don't just assume that the way your parent feels towards you is roughly the same way that you feel towards their parent. No, it's a whole different magnitude because you were born because of them. They weren't born because of you. And your mother, you spent 9 months inside her body. You know, this is just a very different kind of emotional relationship that parents have towards their children. So there's going to be attachment. If you have a romantic attachment, you love your partner or your spouse, there's going to be some attachment there. I don't think it's realistic to say you could have that kind of love without. But as a householder, someone living in the world, you weigh things up. And you say, yeah, attachment leads to suffering, for sure. More attachment, more suffering. But weighing it up, the pros of that kind of love outweigh the cons. I'm willing. You should go into it with your eyes open and say, "Yeah, this relationship is going to cause me some suffering. It's not going to be all happiness. Even the best, closest couples, well, I think would agree to that, just through the very nature of attachment. But what you can do." Is to, as I suggested yesterday, these kinds of reflections are on old age, sickness, death, separation, just to make this just a part of the way you understand yourself and your relationships in the world, has a very maturing effect. Because attachment gets very strong. I don't want to think about that. You say, well, one day, you know, you're going to be separated. You know, one day you're going to die. You say, I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about that. It's morbid. It's depressing. But you have to just push yourself a little bit and be willing to accept that. And with parents, again, you know, there are certain amounts, certain level of attachment, which is, I think, impossible, let's say, to let go of. But we make it so much worse, like the parents who want to protect their child from every single possible kind of suffering, or even every kind of possibility of suffering. And then it becomes too much, you know, what they call helicopter parenting these days. And that kind of, everything about my child, and every single up and down at school becomes a major family crisis. Being able just to allow your children to make mistakes, allow your children to suffer a little bit, you know, because that's how they grow. That's how they become fully rounded human beings. So attachment will always be there, but there's a lot of unnecessary attachment that we can let go of, would be my view on this. Should we have kids if we aim for nirvana? For the very highest levels of practice, say realizing arahantship in this life, then the celibate life is definitely best. And that's why we have, yes, one of the pillars of the monastic order. But at the same time, there have been householders, men and women, living in the world, raising children, who have realized at least stream entry, the first level of enlightenment, which is, that's the major jump, that's the quantum leap from the unenlightened level to the first level of enlightenment. That's the key one. Because that first, what we call quantum leap, means that it is no longer possible ever to go backwards, to regress. And it's impossible to be born in a lower realm ever again. And it is inevitable that within seven lifetimes at most, you will realize complete enlightenment. So this is what's called entering the stream. It's like you're entering a river, and whatever happens, that river will take you to the sea at one point in the future. So that is incredible achievement. And many, over the years, many men and women have realized that that level, living in the world and raising families. So raising kids makes it a lot more complicated, and as I say, it creates certain attachments that are kind of difficult to deal with, but it's not a complete, you know, it's not because you have kids you can give up on enlightenment. It's not that serious. How to cultivate a rich inner life. Can Buddhist teaching help with that? Well, yes, that's the whole point. So, you know, it depends also what you mean by a rich inner life. It's certainly true that a number of things that you may enjoy before start practicing may become less interesting as you become more advanced in the Dhamma. But as certain kinds of enjoyments and pleasures pass away, become less interesting, then others replace them. So there is this very strong inner sense of calm. And so I was talking to somebody the other day, and she's in her 80s now, and she was very successful, had a very successful life, very wealthy, well-known celebrity in her time. And then she met one of the disciples of Ajahn Mun, and within some time her whole life changed. And to the amazement of all the people who knew her, she entered a monastery and spent the rest of her life in a forest monastery. So she was talking about how her life changed when she first started listening and practicing the Dhamma. And it's so beautiful, because I really felt I understood what she meant. She said, you know, I'd go to listen to talks in the evening, and then at work during the day, whatever I was doing, I was feeling like in my heart, inside, that nobody could see, there was a big smile. So my heart was smiling. And I thought, yeah, that's such a beautiful way of expressing how you feel when you start to really get into the practice of Dhamma. You're doing your duties, you may be working or looking after children or whatever, but inside you just have this sense of, outside you might be like really dook, you know, but inside you just have a sense of a inner smile. So that's kind of rich inner life, I think. Okay. What is your purpose in life? How has it evolved over time? Well, since I was a teenager, my goal, or the thing that I wanted above all else, was wisdom. I wanted to be a wise person. That was my dream. But it's very hard to pin down what wisdom means. You know, particularly in the West, you know, the word's used in very kind of imprecise way. And if you look up these kind of wisdom stories and wisdom in books, and it doesn't seem to me very clear. So the idea that I came to was that the way to cultivate wisdom is to have as many experiences as possible. And so I became a kind of a cultivator of experience. You know, so I left home at 17 and hitchhiked and took cheap buses all the way across Europe and Asia to India. Then after my money ran out, I read a book, a Buddhist book, about the sermons of a Zen master given to his students. And it really struck me. He said, you know, you're practicing purely. So I was interested in Buddhism by this time and so on. Then never worry about where your next meal is coming from and where, you know, it'll just come by itself. So I thought this was just such a cool idea. So I thought, I'm going to see if I can travel. I was in Pakistan. And see if I can travel from Pakistan to England with no money. So I didn't have much money anyway, but I kept $10. I put a $10 note in my sock and set off from central Pakistan hitchhiking. And hitchhiked through Pakistan and right across Afghanistan, which was really hairy. And lots of adventures, and some of them very dangerous. And then hitchhiked all the way across Iran again. Pretty dangerous and lots of adventures. And I got to Turkey, and not only did I have no money, but I lost my passport. I had to go back, and lots more adventures. And then ended up living with a family in Tehran and saved money and went back to India again. And lived as a kind of a yogi in the mountains and in the desert for a while with some Hindu teachers. And so I had so many different experiences. But while I was traveling, I met other people who'd had even more kind of incredible experiences than me. And I realized I got it wrong, that experience, even kind of weird and wonderful and incredible experiences, they don't necessarily lead to wisdom. There's not this kind of inevitable process, but wisdom, experience leads to memory. That's all. And I met many people who had developed certain prejudices while they were traveling, and then after that, every new experience I was just put into these little boxes that they developed. So they were not open to anything new. And I found this particularly true when people travel as couples. I think that's the most dead way to travel. You know, if you're going to somewhere new, is you go with two of you, because you just kind of feed into yourself all the time and reinforce your prejudices. So I like going by myself. So I realized that experience was just one. I mean, some of the things I put up with and some of the things I did, you know, and I'd always think, wow, this is a real experience. You know, this is my kind of feeling. I made a profit because I'd had a special kind of experience. So as I got more into Buddhist teaching, then I realized, like, Buddhism teaches that wisdom arises from a clear understanding of ourselves, our body, our mind, the world we live in, and that the mind in its normal untrained state is not yet a good enough instrument by which you can develop this kind of understanding. So the training of the mind is absolutely essential to the development of wisdom. So this is what led me into more emphasis on meditation and Buddhist practice and eventually to become a monk. But in short, I think that how I would summarize Buddhist view of the purpose of life is this is very simply to create and to cultivate happiness and benefit or welfare for yourself and for others. So these two aspects, leading a life in which you are happy and peaceful and wise and fulfilled, but also doing your best to promote those values in the society in which you live in and try to improve the society in which you live in. And I found that to fulfill both those sides of my aspiration, then life as a monk provides the best possible vehicle to do that, both in providing the supportive conditions for my own cultivation, but also to give a grounding and an opportunity to help others. Okay, how do we explain fate and destiny in Buddhism? Is there any relation to karma? Okay, so we explain them as being non-existent. We don't believe in that things are fated to happen or there's a destiny, but there are strong probabilities that things will happen. But nothing is completely fixed in that way. People who read your hand, they don't want to. They don't feel confident in making predictions for people who practice Dhamma, because once you start practicing, then you're going beyond these kinds of set roots in life. So again, going back to someone who has no spiritual cultivation, then their life is, although they don't realize it and would be very upset or disagree if you said so, but their life is very automatic. Even people who have a lot of money and a lot of freedom to do what they want, they're being driven by all kinds of unconscious forces and prisoner of their likes and their dislikes and their fears and their expectations and so on. Now, if your life is basically reactive like that, if your life is being conditioned by all kinds of things of which you are unaware of, then there is I think possibility of prediction, and things can be a lot more clear-cut. But the moment you start practicing Dhamma, then you're creating new karma, when the old karma is really seen as an option. So it's like raw material. But what you do with it is up to you in the present moment. And the more you practice mindfulness, the more choices you have. So without mindfulness, you have very few choices, although you might think you have, but you're basically kidding yourself. So the more aware you are, the more mindful you are, the more choices you have, and the less you are subject to fate or destiny. So karma is key to this. What are your thoughts on the LGBTQ? This list seems to get longer and longer, isn't it? If you're a part of it, how should you come out to your family, if at all? Yeah, I don't really have that many thoughts. I mean, I think that one of the great strengths of Thai society, and it's been obscured a bit now because of Western influence, but there can be no more society in the world which is open to diversity as Thai society has been. And the growing up in the West, where even when I was young, you know, someone who would be gay or any LGBT, you know, it's physically dangerous to go outside or go into town or go out anywhere, very likely to get physically attacked and people abused and treated dreadfully for being different. This incredible fear of someone who's different. And I would say in Thailand that there's very little of that. And what there is I would say, is the product of cultural influences from other countries, from other traditions, religious traditions. So as a monk, then I speak in favor of the precepts. And the third precept of refraining from sexual misconduct just means honesty, integrity, kindness in sexual relations. And so if somebody is committed to a relationship, whether it's heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, etc., the principles remain the same. You treat that person, whoever he is or she is, with respect and kindness, and you don't cheat on them, you don't deceive them. So for me, that's the important point, not the sexual orientation of the person, but the kindness and integrity with which we conduct our intimate relations. So I don't think that there's anything inherently bad in any kind of sexual orientation. It's how you live with it, how you deal with it, how you treat others. But of course, people's views on these things vary, and whether or not, how, when you come out, if you come out, then that's going to depend a lot on your family and their values and how the opinions they've expressed on these things. And if you are a member of one of these this community, then you're finding out from friends and people who are in similar situation how they've dealt with it. But I would hope that these days that families are able to accept this more now. I think one of our difficulties for people this age, many difficulties coming from the fact that families are so much smaller now, and that whereas before people would have 4, 5, 6 kids, now it's 1 or maybe 2. So parents put just so much on their one, you know, it's their whole life on one child. So if the child is turning out in a way that that disappoints them, or, you know, particularly if their dream is to have grandchildren and then you come out as gay, you know, then, you know, there's going to be some pain involved. Although even now, you know, with adoption and all these other things, you know, that's not necessarily a bar even to having children these days. But it's going to be difficult, and the difficulty will vary from family to family. I think in the, you know, big picture, I think coming out is will probably in long term be the best thing to do. But how you do it, and it's just to give it a lot of thought, and to be, as I say, with parents, you know, just really try to see this from their point of view. But I would hope that the parents' love for you as their child would outweigh any dismay about your sexual orientation. Okay, Tiang, 12 o'clock. It's more or less all the questions. A couple more.